The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jory Slotkey from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the April 2019 issue of Discover Magazine. We begin with the cover story, Meet the T-Rex Family. Scientists rethink the social network of the iconic predator and its ancestors. A truck barrels down a dusty desert road in southern Utah's vast Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, speeding through canyons and along cliffs toward a towering sandstone formation known as the Kepirawatis Plateau. Alan Titus, a Bureau of Land Management paleontologist here for nearly 20 years, is behind the wheel, his shaggy hair flapping in the July wind as Led Zeppelin blasts from the speakers. Titus stops the truck on a shrubby hill. With his passenger, University of North Florida paleontologist Barry Albright, he sets off on a small footpath into the high desert. The two men, longtime friends and collaborators, are heading into the scene of a catastrophe, and possibly the biggest find of Titus's decades-long career. In 2014, Titus was prospecting for dinosaurs when he kicked over a bit of bone beside a scraggly old juniper tree. It was a piece of skull from a tyrannosaur, animals that include Tyrannosaurus rex and dozens of related and ancestral species. Since that chance find, Titus and his team have recovered remains from four tyrannosaurs, an adult, a teenager, and two juveniles, from a site about 1,000 square feet in size. Titus thinks these tyrannosaurs died together some 76 million years ago during the Cretaceous period. If he's right, it could confirm a controversial idea about one of the most iconic dinosaurs that ever lived. Tyrannosaurs have been found from the Arctic Circle to the subtropics, and for decades, paleontologists have debated whether these top predators were social creatures. But fossil evidence has been hard to find. That's why this is exciting, Titus says. He believes that these animals are the direct ancestors of Tyrannosaurus rex living in a complex social group. But not everyone is convinced. It's hard to tell just from bones, says Albright, who helped work the site. He pauses and adds, their brains are too small to hunt in packs. Titus isn't dissuaded. Even the site's nickname is a nod to his enthusiastic optimism. Team members call it rainbows and unicorns. Pop culture usually portrays tyrannosaurs as loners ravaging the landscape. Remember Jurassic Park? Not animals with complex social relationships. But a handful of recent discoveries may be prompting a revision. In 2014, for example, paleontologists announced a trio of tracks in British Columbia from adult tyrannosaurs, possibly Albertosaurus, walking together in the mud. The following year, a study in the journal PeerJ described fossil evidence that suggested tyrannosaurs often bedded each other's faces, likely during competition. Titus and some of his colleagues believe that these finds suggest that the predators may have moved in packs, jockeyed for social hierarchy, and perhaps even cared for their young through adolescence. Many modern predators exhibit these behaviors, but the long-standing dinosaur stereotype is that their brains just weren't big enough for such sophisticated relationships. A lot of that is simple bias against reptiles, says University of Maryland paleontologist and tyrannosaur expert Thomas Holtz, Jr. Crocodilians engage in play, deception, and problem-solving, things that people once thought that they didn't have the brains to do. And because tyrannosaurs were brainier for their body size than any crocodile, it's reasonable to expect that they'd be capable of even more complex behaviors, Holtz says. It's possible, in fact, that tyrannosaur brains explain their rise to dominance in the first place. The first animals to be considered tyrannosaurs show up in the fossil record 170 million years ago. But if you were placing bets on a future super predator, you wouldn't have put your money on them. Proceratosaurus, shorter than a human and not particularly terrifying, was discovered in England a century ago, but only identified as a tyrannosaur in 2010. The reason tyrannosaurs took over as the dominant predator is still a question, says Joseph Sertic of the Denver Museum of Nature and Science, who worked with Titus on rainbows and unicorns. They seemed to be in the right place at the right time. That right time began about 100 million years ago, when a period of intense volcanic activity caused a mini mass extinction in the northern hemisphere, killing many of the larger dinosaurs, including all allosaurs, the apex predators of their day. There's a gap in the tyrannosaur fossil record of several million years, but it appears that, after this event, Tyrannosaurs began their climb to the top of the food chain, and some researchers speculate their smarts may have helped them do it. In 2016, paleontologists described a well-preserved skull from a tyrannosaur that lived in Uzbekistan 90 million years ago. The fossil suggested that this horse-sized tyrannosaur, Timurlengia utica, had keen senses. Its large inner ears would have allowed it to hear low-frequency sounds, a common trait in predators that hunt larger animals over long distances. The researchers believe it's evidence that the tyrannosaur brain allowed it to become an apex predator long before the animals reached their peak size. By the time an asteroid wiped out the non-avian dinosaurs 66 million years ago, an adult T-Rex could weigh 10 tons and stretch some 40 feet from nose to tail, one of the largest predators to ever walk the Earth. Through much of the Cretaceous, a vast body of water called the Western Interior Seaway divided North America into two distinct landmasses. In the west, a long, thin strip of a continent called Laramidia extended from Alaska towards Central America. And at that time, the region of Utah, now encompassing Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, was sandwiched between the Seaway and a mountain range comparable to the modern Andes. The subtropical region received more than 60 inches of rain during an annual wet season. Rivers meandered past redwoods and palms. Enormous herds of plant-eating dinosaurs grazed along the muddy banks, including duck-billed dinosaurs, horned ceratopsians, and the tank-like armored ankylosaurs. Ecosystems back then were not all that different than ecosystems today, says University of Alberta paleontologist Phil Curie, who has studied tyrannosaur bone beds in western North America and Asia. Thousands of fossilized duck-billed hadrosaur footprints were found in Alaska's Denali National Park and Preserve in 2014, showing the animals moved like elephants in large herds of both young and old. By analyzing other herbivores' teeth for elements that can provide a record of location, scientists say they've found evidence that some dinosaurs migrated seasonally. These plant-eater herds would have been well-protected against a lone predator, Curry says, but a group of tyrannosaurs could break up the herd to take on a single large animal. In today's ecosystems, where you have big groups of herbivores, you have big groups of carnivores, says Curry. We shouldn't expect animals to behave so differently back then, he says. In 1996, Curry was at the American Museum of Natural History in New York, rummaging through the collections of Barnum Brown, the famed dinosaur hunter who discovered the first T-Rex skeleton back in 1902. When Curry opened a cabinet drawer, he found the left foot of the smaller tyrannosaur Albertosaurus, which Brown had brought back from a field expedition in 1910. I opened the next drawer, and there's another foot, Curry says. By the time his team finished going through the cabinets, they had found fossils from nine individuals. Curry's luck wasn't up yet. The archives had pictures of a dig site on a distinctive ridge at Dry Island Buffalo Jump Provincial Park in Alberta, Canada. He set off to find it the following year. It ended up being one of the hottest days of the year, so when I found the ridge, I was at heat exhaustion, Curry says. I didn't think of looking around my feet. The next day we came back, and there was Albertosaurus bone everywhere. Back in 1910, Brown worked only a 65-by-65-foot section. The larger site that Curie's team excavated held bones belonging to possibly 20 or more tyrannosaurs, killed in a single event some 70 million years ago. Growth rings on the bones show the animals' ages ranged from 2 to 24 years old, possibly parents and offspring. How young tyrannosaurs made their way in the world has long been a hotbed of speculation. At 2 years old, an infant T-Rex, for example, was the size of a golden retriever, with teeth not much bigger. Some paleontologists believe sexual maturity came around 18 years old. Along the way, their proportions morphed from sleek-bodied, narrow-skulled youth into school bus-sized adults with broad skulls and teeth as big as bananas. Based on the range of animals at the Dry Island site, Curry wonders if the younger, faster tyrannosaurs might have run into herds, flushing out prey for the adults, suggesting a division of labor within a hunting pack. As a scientist, you've got to be cautious, Carthage College paleontologist Thomas Carr says of the Albertosaurus mass grave and some of the speculation about it. Other animals, such as Komodo dragons, for example, gather in groups to feed, but lack complex social relationships. We've just got to wait to see if scientists find more bone beds like it to see if that holds up. It's just one site. Back in Utah, rainbows and unicorns should back up Curry's Dry Island hypothesis, but the finds from the Kapirwatis Plateau have yet to be published. At Titus's lab in Kanab, Utah, in a room the size of a large garage, bones are scattered across every flat surface. Half a dozen volunteers, mostly local retirees, hover over workstations, using compressed air scribes that look like tattoo guns to pick minuscule chunks of rock from tyrannosaur fossils and plaster jackets. It's tedious work. Studying the site has proven to be a monumental task, in part because the rock is exceptionally hard. The fossils themselves are mostly what Titus calls kibbles and bits, thousands of jumbled pieces from dozens of different puzzles. Each fragment must be cataloged, studied, and if possible, reassembled. Rainbows and Unicorns is a very unusual bone bed, says Sertic, the Denver Museum of Nature and Science paleontologist. I've never seen anything even remotely like it. It's like a spaghetti noodle cluster of bones. How these creatures died, however, may prove to be less of a puzzle. The Tyrannosaur remains were found near each other, but the larger dig site also holds half a dozen 3-foot-plus turtle shells, along with remnants of giant fish called gars, parts of a 20-foot crocodile, and other bones. Other than the Tyrannosaurs, the other fossils are mostly aquatic creatures. That's because the site was once a roughly mile-wide lake. Titus believes the Tyrannosaurs drowned there together, possibly washed in by a flood. The lake eventually dried up in a subsequent drought, killing off the fish and other aquatic animals. In a corner of the lab, volunteer Deb Shanahan wears a face mask and a lab coat as she chisels away at an infant Tyrannosaur skull encased in rock. She started on the skull back in September 2016. With each new section of fossil exposed, Shanahan becomes the first to see an animal that's been locked up in rock for 76 million years. On a large table nearby, Titus and other volunteers are revealing the menacing grimace of an adult Tyrannosaur's massive skull and teeth. The team suspects their dinosaurs could belong to a species called Teratophenus cururei, or monstrous murderer, named after Curry. The species lived in this region, but is known only from a partial specimen. Having four more individuals could reveal details about the species' development from infancy to adulthood. However, unlike T. cureri and other local tyrannosaurs, all four of the new specimens have a flat lacrimal bone, which sits above the eye socket, that could indicate it's a new species altogether. The team won't know for some time. They've been chipping away material from the adult's giant skull for more than 2 years, but months of work remain. Titus isn't in a rush. I'll only get one shot in my career to work on something cool, he says. It's a disservice to my co-authors and to science to not take my time. When ignorance is bliss, why we sometimes choose not to know. A few months ago, out of curiosity, I took a genetic test to trace my ancestry. The results mostly confirmed what I had already suspected. I was a blend of Eastern European and Ashkenazi Jewish heritage. Then came an offer to see a medical analysis of my DNA, an opportunity to learn about the bits of my genome that increase my risk of developing disease. Again, I was curious. But as I started ticking a series of boxes informing me that I could discover something upsetting, I suddenly thought to myself, you know what? Never mind. I don't have to know this. This decision was out of character. I always want to know things, preferably as soon as possible. After a job interview, I constantly refresh my inbox, impatient to hear back. But finding out if I get the gig sooner rather than just a few hours later changes very little. Knowing my genetic risks and ways to mitigate them, however, is potentially life-changing. So why was I so content to stay in the dark? As a neuroscience grad student, I decided to do a little digging to learn how humans can be so curious, yet simultaneously harbor such a love of ignorance. As I searched through the science, it became clear that our desire to know things, or not, is closely tied with dopamine, the chemical messenger of the brain's reward centers. For decades, researchers have known that dopamine-releasing brain cells become highly active when we expect a reward or when we encounter rewards that are better than we anticipate. For example, if you assume that you'll do well on a test, but you unexpectedly ace it, your dopamine levels will spike. This spike compels us to repeat the same behavior or return to the same environment in search of more. But more recently, scientists discovered that dopamine cells don't just care about tangible rewards. They also seem to care about information, even if it's useless. The key study came in 2009. Scientists at the National Institutes of Health trained monkeys to look at a screen in exchange for drops of water. Next, the monkeys got to choose between looking at a meaningless image or one that revealed the size of their next water drop. Getting this heads up didn't influence whether or not they got water, but the monkeys still heavily preferred the hint over ignorance. Once more, dopamine-releasing neurons that buzzed with activity in the buildup to getting the water also fired up when the monkeys were waiting to learn how big their next water drop would be. This discovery points to a fascinating possibility. The brain's dopamine system treats the chance to obtain a reward and the chance to gain information as equally exciting. This might offer a clue as to why we often just want to know. In the next few years, researchers observed something similar in humans. In studies where people anticipated information that would resolve a puzzle or a trivia question, their dopamine hubs lit up, just as the monkeys had. More recently, in 2018, researchers at the University of Melbourne discovered a parallel between how the brain reacts when we're anticipating both rewards and information, and how it reacts when those things fail to live up to our expectations. Their study, published in the journal Scientific Reports, recorded the electrical activity of 22 participants' brains while they played a series of lottery games involving cards. Players had two options: remain ignorant of the lottery's results until the end, or pay a fee deducted from any winnings to learn the outcome in advance. No matter their decision, players saw five cards revealed one by one to be either black or red. For players who choose not to know the lottery outcome ahead of time, these cards didn't matter. But for those who did want the scoop, a black majority signaled an upcoming win. Whenever participants saw a red card revealed, indicating that they could be on their way to a loss, their brains produced a specific electrical signal, but it wasn't the only time the signal showed up. Sometimes a card, either red or black, that made the outcome less certain would be revealed to a player who opted to learn the results in advance. Interestingly, when this happened, that same electrical signal showed up regardless of the card's color. Apparently, when the promise of obtaining useful information is denied, the brain reacts as if it missed out on an actual reward. Practically speaking, this neurochemical entanglement might explain why I often want to know things just out of curiosity. If both tangible rewards and information can be cashed in for a dopamine rush, then both have legitimate crave-worthy value. Now I wonder if my paying for my technically useless ancestry report is part of a drawn-out chase for a hit of dopamine. Accepting that my brain really does value information as much as it does physical rewards, that brings me to my next question. Why? The research of Marco Vasconcelos, an animal behaviorist at Portugal's University of Aveiro, gives me some insight. In a 2015 study on starlings, he describes how he gave the birds a choice between pecking two buttons. One button immediately informed them about whether they were about to be rewarded. The second provided no information, but resulted in a higher chance of rewards. Shockingly, the starlings heavily preferred the informative, lower reward button. To Vasconcelos, this makes perfect evolutionary sense. If uncertainty is not eliminated as soon as possible, he explains, an animal may pursue prey that has a reasonable probability of escaping. Similarly, we may actively avoid being uncertain about the future so we don't waste time on fruitless pursuits, something that might have meant going hungry back when resources were scarce. This drive could have hardwired our brains to constantly seek information. On a subjective level, this idea makes sense. I definitely hate uncertainty. Still, this doesn't mesh with my choice to avoid seeing the medical analysis of my genome. How to explain that choice? Researchers at University College London and Washington University in St. Louis published a paper that helped me better understand. In their study, published in 2018 in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, the team set up a lottery scenario where participants had no control over the outcome. Players went through multiple rounds where they could either win or lose money at random and collect their total earnings in the end. But at the start of each round, they saw their odds, framed as a percentage chance of either winning or of losing that turn. Once they knew the odds, players could then give their preference for learning the round's outcome. Crucially, though, they knew their choice wouldn't affect their total earnings. All the while, the researchers tracked the players' brain activity. The team found that when probabilities were framed as chances of winning, people were much more likely to choose to be informed. On those occasions, their reward circuits were highly active. But when probabilities were framed as a potential loss, even when the odds of winning and losing were the same, fewer people chose to be informed. And their brains reflected this paradoxical behavior with lower levels of activity in brain areas that pump out dopamine. It seems that the biological equation information equals reward comes with a serious caveat. Our brains treat positive information as a reward to be approached, but negative information more as a punishment to be avoided, says Caroline Carpentier, the study's lead author. When I ask her why we evade negative information, she argues that it comes down to the value of beliefs. When we have positive beliefs about what's about to happen to us, we are about to get a salary raise, we feel good, she says. Meanwhile, if we have negative beliefs, we are about to receive negative feedback on an assignment, we feel bad. So avoiding potentially negative information not only helps us reduce the uncertainty in our lives, it can help us try to keep our positive beliefs intact. When I look back on my decision to remain ignorant of my genetic risks, I wonder if it was the potential of learning some bad medical news that trumped my usual frustration with uncertainty. After all, my years of studying the brain have made me all too aware of how untreatable many neurological conditions really are. Ultimately, I agreed with my brain's reasoning. Maybe it's better not to know. And now, a science smackdown. Are human astronauts worth it? Experts debate whether people or probes make the best space explorers. Decades before anyone had built a rocket, Earthlings had already argued in science fiction about who is more suited for space travel, humans or machines. Today, the debate rages on as private players like SpaceX and government agencies like NASA vie to send people to the moon, Mars, and beyond. But such missions are costly, and human bodies remain sensitive to space's harsh conditions. Maybe robots would simply prove better, cheaper, and faster. In Science Smackdown, we let experts argue the evidence. First, the claim, the human touch. When Tony Antonelli was an Apollo-era kid, he wanted to be an astronaut. But not to be the first person on Mars. That person would surely land long before Antonelli grew up. Antonelli did become an astronaut, but he overestimated how fast humans would explore space. He retired from the Corps, and NASA still hasn't put anyone on Mars. Nevertheless, he wants to keep people in the launch recipe. Robots don't explore, he says. Humans explore. People react in real time, whereas robots require instructions, he says, which results in solid but slow progress. The Martian rovers, for instance, have crawled 45 miles in 26 years, never deviating from NASA's instructions. In contrast, Antonelli recalls Apollo 15's seatbelt rock. Astronauts saw something interesting, asked to check it out, and were told no. They then pretended a seatbelt had unbuckled, stopped the rover, and grabbed the rock anyway. Robots, not so sly. As a technologist at Lockheed Martin, Antonelli now guides NASA's next crewed mission, which may launch within 5 years. He argues that keeping humans involved, through discomfort, expense, and even danger, makes space travel more meaningful and productive. And now the counterpoint, robotic efficiency. The new space race is like the tortoise and the hare, contends Howard McCurdy. The rabbit decides to take a nap, and the turtle just keeps coming, says the American University public policy professor and co-author of Robots in Space. At the start of the space race, humans were more capable than robots. They could think, survive, and see better. Then those humans developed technology that slowly but steadily upped the robot game, making uncrewed missions more attractive. For instance, compared with the Spirit and Opportunity rovers, which landed in 2004, the Curiosity rover, which touched down just 8 years later, is more than 3 times larger and 10% faster. It gets 3 times as much power from the sun and has twice as many science instruments. And that's not to mention its advances in computing power and artificial intelligence. Astronauts have to breathe, eat, drink, and keep their demons at bay. Robots fly free of such constraints. They can do more, go more places, and, because they don't require life support systems and are thus cheaper than human missions, do it all more often. But they still require human direction, don't have their own curiosity or interpretive skills, and they move slower than a crawl. Ultimately, McCurdy envisions a transhuman program. Spacefaring humans could siliconify, uploading their brains into a machine mind. You've got a total machine that works, thinks, and acts like a human being, says McCurdy. Perhaps it will take the best of both worlds to explore other ones. And now, 20 things you didn't know about seasons. Number one, don't look to Pete Seeger's lyric, turn, 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 to explain the seasons. It's really tilt, tilt, tilt. Earth has seasons because its axis is tilted about 23.5 degrees, exposing the northern and southern hemispheres to fluctuating amounts of direct sunlight during the year. Number two, contrary to popular belief, Earth's distance from the sun, which changes along its elliptical orbit, has nothing to do with seasonal differences in temperature and sunlight. That orbit shifts over a roughly 100,000-year cycle, however, and at its most extreme may increase solar radiation by up to 30%, affecting overall climate. Number three, Most astronomers believe that about 4.5 billion years ago, a Mars-sized body knocked into our young planet, causing the axial tilt. By the way, that tilt, or obliquity, varies over a roughly 40,000-year cycle, from 22.1 to 24.5 degrees. Number 4. More tilt means hotter summers and colder winters. Decreased tilt results in less extreme swings in temperature. Number 5. Scientists don't yet know how common wobbly planets like ours are, but Earth's seasonality may help them find signs of life elsewhere, according to a 2018 paper in the Astrophysical Journal Letters. Number 6. Current exoplanet analyses look for atmospheric oxygen, methane, and other gases necessary for, or produced by, living organisms. But hunting for these so-called biogenic gases is imprecise and assumes life forms have metabolism similar to earthly beings. Number 7. A more reliable exoplanet biosignature, say the authors of the 2018 research, might be seasonal changes in atmospheric composition, which reflect the connection between the planet and the life adapted to live on it. Number 8. On Earth, for example, carbon dioxide levels are lower in summer, when most plants are actively absorbing it, than in winter, when vegetation dies or goes dormant. Number 9. Animals, meanwhile, have a host of seasonal adaptation strategies, such as migration, which may mean a change in altitude, latitude, or hemisphere. Birds are perhaps the most famous migrators, including the Arctic tern, which flies from far northern breeding grounds to Antarctica and back again every year. Number 10. Many marine animals also migrate, even if they don't move geographically. Seasonal changes in oxygen levels force many fish, crustaceans, and mollusks to relocate higher or lower within the water column. Number 11. All 4 species of African lungfish, however, stay right where they are, even in the dry season when their freshwater habitats may disappear. They survive thanks to estivation. Number 12. Like hibernation, which is an adaptation strategy for prolonged cold, estivation is a state of lowered metabolism and inactivity, but it occurs during hot or dry seasons. Number 13. Depending on the species, African lungfish estivate after burrowing into the soil to find permanent moisture, or even secreting their own comfy mucus onesie. Number 14. Some insects have evolved seasonal variation within a single population. Take Apis mellifera, the western honeybee, for example. In temperate climates, worker bees born in spring and summer live for a few weeks, rearing brood and foraging for nectar and pollen. And we'll end with number 15. In the same colony, however, winter workers, which emerge as foraging opportunities decline in autumn, may live for 6 months or more. These winter bees spend most of their time in a cluster around the queen to keep warm. We've run out of time for today's episode of Discover. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jory Slodkey, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comment or questions, please call area code 919-832-5138. Again, that's area code 919-832-5138.